Group meeting, Saturday, 13th August, 1988. If I can confess quite honestly, I do not know. I am beyond the conflict between pride and humility, between conceit and modesty. I am truly meeked then. Then I can stand in adoring awe, the fear of the Lord, before the transcendent mystery, asking for nothing whatsoever, letting God be God. You know, that's a very interesting way of putting it. It's not original to me. It occurs in, in The Cloud of Unknowing, in that book. Let God be God. You know the tendency of human beings to describe God. And all that they describe is just a projection of themselves in apotheosis. Somebody is kind, therefore God is absolutely kind. Somebody is gentle, therefore God is absolutely gentle, and so on and so on. Which is nonsensical. When I, contained here and now by Mother Earth, chastened, can say with the simple assurance of the innocent, I do not know, my heart is freed of heaviness, and Mother Earth takes me into the land of light and lays me at the feet of the holy. Then only I, the Son of Man, grow into my full manhood. And when the wisdom love of my Father God overfills my heart and radiates into His kingdom, the universal glory of the one transcendent real, then transcendence has blazed into self-awareness through me. We are the instruments, the apparatus through which transcendence manifests its transcendence as the perfected human, no more, no less. Only the light will shine. Then, the me will remain invisible and will die consummated. As if one dies after such realization, such fulfillment, then it is the consummation of the purpose of one's own existence. Do we see the body of the sun or light? That is what remains, what is seen. To know the fact of I do not know is the healthy root for true faith. Belief empty, I am faithful. Empty of belief equals being full of faith. Because all our beliefs constrict the truth. They despoil the truth. Where there is no web of illusions and fixed ideas spun out by sense brain activity, pure mind shines. These are not mere words. Come clean and you will be that delight. You see, all our illusions and our fixed ideas, our conditioning, is due is due to the activity of the senses interpreted by the brain through using the instrument of language. And as we grow, develop, truly develop, these fixed ideas vanish away. It's the fixation which is the trouble, not the idea. Because ideas, they have to be. They will be there, always. However advanced a person may be, whatever revelation he may have, he can express it only in terms of words, ideas, thoughts, and so forth. That's the only means of communication which we have. But that expression becomes purer and purer, less illusory, as one frees oneself from one's various beliefs. Beliefs are amongst the most powerful conditioning factors in our life. To know the fact of I do not know is the healthy root for true faith. Oh yes, I have read that. Where there is no web of illusions and fixed ideas spun out by sense brain activity, pure mind shines. Pure mind is the universal mind. We all say my mind, your mind, his mind, and so forth. There's no such thing as my mind. My psyche, yes. The psyche is my particular intellectual, emotional expression of mind function, of universal mind functioning through my brain and nervous system and ductus glands and so forth, through the psyche, in short. That must be remembered. The shining of pure mind is the source of right comprehension. Whatever comprehension is permitted to us. We must remember that however much we develop, however perfected one becomes, there is always a limit because the human constitution has a limit. It can't go beyond that limit. The mystery of Krishna's revelations that the indestructible unmanifest is the abode of Him, the Supreme Person, and that He in turn is the abode of the indestructible unmanifest, is the mystery of the container and contained. We think of container and contained as two separate things. A box which contains some objects. It's not like that. The contained produces its own container. This is one of the remarkable teachings which you'll find in the Kabbalistic writings, that by self-constraint, the contained produces its container. And that container is the manifestation which is the outcome of that constriction by the container. That is the universal manifestation. I've put here, transcendence resists transcendence. And by that act of resistance, it produces the container. Transcendence produces the cosmos by self-constraint. And that self-constraint is the resistance against itself, which brings about a product, a result. This is the primordial karmic act out of which the entire universal process unfolds. And it is due to self-love. That self-love was the stir in transcendence which made transcendence desire to know itself. To know itself in terms of form and shape, because transcendence itself is shapeless and formless. But it wanted to know its own transcendence by producing form and shape. So, resisting itself, it produced its own container. It became its own container. That means not the whole of it became its own container, but a part of it becomes its own container. And even that phrase is an inaccurate phrase, because you can't talk of a part of transcendence. Transcendence is the absolute totality. And yet language defeats, well, certainly defeated media. The primordial energy, immeasurable, undifferentiated, interplays with itself, giving rise to vortices of energy, measurable because of the production of differentiation. Cosmos appears where no cosmos was. No categories, space, time, etc., apply where the primordial is concerned. They are coterminous with cosmos. Once cosmos comes into being, then we have space, time, and all the various categories, ontologies of all the philosophical systems. Yet cosmos and the primordial are an identity. This is, of course, the mystery which the human brain will never understand. Because the human brain functions as a human brain only by virtue of restriction, only by virtue of conditioning. So the brain cannot deal with it. But when the brain is still and quiet, really quiet, and it doesn't produce any words or thoughts, then you become conscious of this mystery. It remains a mystery always, but you become conscious of it. And in that consciousness of the mystery, you are at one with the Supreme. This is the great Unio Mystica, or rather what happens during the Unio Mystica. This ancient esoteric tradition is obviously beyond intellectual grasp. You can't describe it, you can't make any logical structure out of it. Nor can you think or speak about it illogically, because you transcend all the aspects of logic. Logic as well as illogic is transcended. But it energizes the perfectly silent-minded one in the I am state. This I am state, of course, refers to that Hebrew phrase, Asher Eheyeh, when the Lord God speaks out of the burning bush and says, Eheyeh, Asher Eheyeh, I am that I am. Asks Moses to say that. And if he asks Moses to say that, it means that Moses experienced this mystery and put it in those words, that out of the burning bush the voice of Yahweh Elohim said, Eheyeh, Asher Eheyeh, I am that I am. That I am, which was always different to the theistical people, because God was placed as out there, this is me, the mortal, the perishable mortal, that is the imperishable immortal, and they separated it. What they never realized then, until much later, was that death, imperishable, immortal, itself becomes the perishable mortal. Because the entire cosmos is perishable. It perishes. It perishes not in the meaning of complete annihilation or destruction, no. But a transformation so extraordinary that one thinks that this is, that the old has been destroyed and the new has come into being. That is why when we talk analogically, we give the example of you've got an old house and the demolishers come and break it up in order that a new one can be built upon that ground. But the transcendent is both the ground and the building. Now, you can't conceive of that with the brain. You can't make a picture of it. But that's how it is. But you can be conscious of it. If the brain, activity of the brain and the interpretation by the brain of the sense impressions is stilled and quiet. This is why the silence becomes so important. The contained is the container and the container is the contained. Let the mind, calm and pure, remain intensely alert and restful, and it will absorb knowledge which is beyond analysis but has perfect clarity. You know how in Genesis it is stated that for 6 days God made everything, and on the seventh day, it was the Sabbath day, the rest. Now, of course, these things were experienced by human beings, and they put it in that form because they realized that God is themselves. But in those days, in those ancient days, if anybody dared to put it openly, "I am God," manifest, he would have been destroyed. He would have been murdered. People were so backward then. You see, they couldn't possibly appreciate the fact. So the entering the Sabbath day of rest means that one has entered that supreme state of consciousness possible to the human constitution. That is the Sabbath, the entry into that supreme silence. If this calm and clarity prevail unperturbed, one will understand Krishna when he says, "I am life immortal and also death. Being and non-being am I." It's a curious statement, isn't it? If an ordinary human, if I were to say that to some chap in the street, walking in the street, he'd say, "This fellow's crackers." Krishna also says, "All-consuming death am I, and the source of all things to come." Don't interpret this just materially, in terms of that which is finite and temporal. All-consuming death am I. This death referred to really is that other life when you enter the silence. This is the death referred to. Because if that were not the case, he couldn't say, "I am the source of all things to come." All things, that's to say, when you return to your ordinary sense brain consciousness, then you function in terms of things, separateness and isolativeness comes into play. But in this state of death, which really means the new life, the other life, the supreme life possible to any human being, then the word death means just that there. In the I am state, life and death, the other life, are realized as the immortal complementaries through Veda Vyasa, the author of the Gita. So too are being, which is the manifest, and non-being, which is the unmanifest. These are the unchanging states of all that is, of all the world. Being flows into non-being, and we who are in being name it death. We say, oh, the man has died, or the woman has died. Non-being flows into being, and we who are in being name it birth. Birth and death are names given in both cases by us who are in being from the standpoint of our natural being. Our standpoint as existential beings, we exist, and therefore we differentiate between birth and death in that way. You see, coming into being, going out of being. And each is an absolute, so to say. Coming into being is an absolute for us whilst we still are conscious in terms, the ordinary terms in which the man in the street is conscious, and death is the opposite. Whilst we are in being, there is within limits identifiable entity which is lost when being flows into non-being. Being is particular, non-being is universal or common. I've put it in inverted commas, common. That means it's just as the atmosphere is common for everybody, the light of the sun is common for everybody, and so on. The one universal non-being, undifferentiated, comes to birth as the many individual beings differentiated. It is essential to understand this in order to understand the becoming process and the meaning of punabhava. The word punabhava means again becoming. Punna, again, bhava, becoming. Mistakenly pictured as reincarnation. When Firoz dies, all that made up Firoz goes back into the totality. What was left unrealized, unfulfilled, with respect to the purpose of his existence and so on, during his lifetime, remains as something which has to be worked out somehow. So, non-being, the universal non-being, which now contains, completely subsumes that which is Firoz, puts out the energy which becomes another human being. And this is how I interpret rebirth and reincarnation. That way there is a meaning to it. But I mean, one can see that there is some sense in that. But the ordinary idea that there is a permanent entity, an immortal permanent entity, is altogether nonsensical, for the simple reason that the very word entity means that which comes into being and goes out of being. No entity is immortal. That's why God, presented as a person by the theistic religions, and person understood as a separate isolated being, an entity, a separate entity, is the tremendous mistake of all theistic ontology and theology. Again becoming Punnabhava as a continuously changing process, not composed of permanent identifiable entities, is true. This was taught by the holy ones, possessed of insight, but the reincarnation picture of it made by the populace is a distortion of the original teaching. This is what I say. Don't believe it, for goodness sake. If you can consider it and find something for yourself, and you become conscious of truth, then stick to that. Don't believe my words. When sense and speech thought activity is stilled, birth, death, interpretation by the living being is absent. That is, when you enter the silence, there is no such thing as birth, death in that state of consciousness. Pure mind is sensitive to the wholeness of being and non-being. Being and non-being are one and the same, really. But the brain finds it almost impossible to picture that. Yes, pure mind is sensitive to the wholeness of being and non-being, manifest and unmanifest, particular and universal. Krishna, that is, the man Vedavyasa, in the state of emergence into the profound beyond discursive mind, states this as, I am life immortal and also death. Being and non-being am I. The other statement, all-consuming death am I, and the source of things to come, tells us of the fact of the streaming movement of being into non-being and non-being into being, the samsaric movement or becoming process of all the world. The Lord, that is, the wholeness of being and non-being, is the one and only transmigrant. The transmigrating is the constant interchanging of states within the one Lord. And I have written a little note to that. If the analogy helps, consider the interchange of states in the following process. Water, visible and tangible. Boil, steam, invisible and intangible. Condense, you get water again. Boil, steam, etc. The interchange of the different states of being, being and non-being. This statement that the Lord is the one and only transmigrant was first made by Ananda Kumara Swami. The man was an extraordinary genius, and his language, poetic prose, everywhere. His mother was a Spaniard, I believe. Not certain. Through the ages, men have believed in angels, demons, spirits, gods, in English, in the Sanskrit, devas, suras, asuras, and so on. For many people, such beliefs are inherited from their elders, or they are the progeny of dreams, fears, ignorance, and superstition. For our purposes, let us omit consideration of this aspect. For some people, that is the aspect of superstition. Is that something? For some people, however, they are symbols for an awareness of that which eludes exact verbal expression. This we may try to understand. Transcendence fecundates mind, the universal mind, which thus holds the archetypal forms and forces of all that is. Because everything that there is in the manifested universe has some sort of archetype from which it derives. This is dimensionless and immeasurable. The archetypal forms and forces are thus shapeless and indescribable, and yet possessed of the potentiality for differentiation. When the Holy One is in the silence, in perfect communion, he is one with the void, which is the archetypal plenitude. That's the astonishing part of it. Again, the brain will never grasp that by itself, but you can become conscious of it. The void is the source of the plenitude. Whilst in a communion, he does not know this archetypal plenitude in the manner that a seeing subject knows an observed object, because it is the conjunction of the opposites which one becomes conscious of. The opposites become one; they are a unity. For instance, in the Judaic tradition, Yahweh is not exclusively masculine and so on. It is masculine, feminine actually. But on the whole, Judaism does not accept that view, that vision of things. Whilst in communion, he does not know this. Yes. The impress of mind during this speechless, thoughtless silence upon the psychophysical organism may afterwards be interpreted in ordinary waking consciousness by brain and by speech thought. When it happens to be an expression of the truth, then those who study and have the intellectual capacity to grasp it form particular concepts, fundamental ideas, as they call them, about these states. This interpretation can be made only in terms of forms, sounds, speech, etc. That is, in terms of the material and faculties of our psychophysical organism and its life and experience. Thus, it is unavoidably a somewhat maimed interpretation. It's bound to be that. It is as if an integrating dimension were excluded. That is what happens when one emerges out of the supreme state of consciousness back again into our ordinary everyday states of consciousness. There are so many dimensions, so many grades which are lost in the process, and therefore the final result is a maimed interpretation. Often it is only a caricature. (Clears throat) For example, you can't understand the three-dimensional world in terms of a two-dimensional being and consciousness. We cannot pack a cube into a square. Just think of it. You have a cube of three dimensions. Can you pack it into a flat surface? You can't. Similarly, as consciousness returns to the ordinary psychophysical material consciousness as such, so many grades are lost in the process. It is, yes. But by virtue of realizing communion, we can, on returning to two-dimensional consciousness, simply affirm that there is that which is over and above our two-dimensional world, and in which our limited world is wholly, though inexplicably, subsumed. Because your cube subsumes infinite squares. If you took an infinite number of squares and tried to place them side by side, you would never get a cube. If the square moves through space, then it brings into being the solid cube. That movement is the sign of life, but no square that we know of moves in that manner. This question of dimensions is a very intricate and an extremely complex one altogether. But modern mathematicians are beginning to have some sort of grasp over it. The interpretation in ordinary waking consciousness is an analytical differentiating activity, as if a prism had refracted the one beam of white light into the several colors of the spectrum. One of the forms produced by this interpretative activity is given all the names comprised in the angelic and demonic orders. That was their way of expressing it. My psyche, being what it is, my qualities, such as kindness, austerity, etc., being what they are, my body being what it is, and my imagination functioning as it does, the angelic and demonic hosts are described in the way I do describe them. My angels and demons are the symbolic portraits, not true to life photographs, of archetypal forces, of cosmic energies beyond my ability to describe exactly or to bend to my will. These the names of angels and archangels represent something which is real. But whatever shape and form we give to it is a mistake. We do that according to what pleases our imagination. But the energies function as such, unquestionably. I know that as a fact. I've experienced that in Kashmir, in Dorset. And so the names of the archangels and angels mean something very specific. They refer to these energies, which are shapeless, formless, but have power. And one of the purposes of human existence is so to purify the psyche that pure mind functions freely through one's psyche. And then one's consciousness contacts this archetypal consciousness. You actually contact Michael or Gabriel, or you can, there are 33 such names in the Zarathustrian scriptures. There are hundreds of such names in the Hindu scriptures, and so on. Besides these angels and demons representing universally operative archetypal forces, there are my own angels and demons, namely my own psychical energies manifesting constructively or destructively, for good or for evil. I am the source of all these energies. You have heard me say time and again, I am God and the devil, both. The devil is more easily apparent. To these, the archetypal forces are related. It is a fact of human experience that meditation or prayer or any mode of communion with the archetypal forces, of which our deep-rooted sense, not mere concept, of God or the Holy or a supreme power are examples, produces results in the psyche of the communicant. Occasionally, even bodily results. Sometimes one is aware of these archetypal forces even without taking any deliberate steps to commune. It is wise to remember that meditation or deep prayer intensifies the good and the evil in us alike. Do remember that. That's why we have that very sensible Hindu saying, when you pray to God for this, that or the other, be very careful what you pray for, because you don't know what you'll get. But whenever a Holy One is in true silence, the human and the angelic world, in their perfection, are joined in action which is pure beneficence.